are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, January 9th, 2020. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the 5th or 6th time award-winning, I don't know, whatever, 5-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Gene Bajelan, professor of history at Missouri State University. We're talking about the history of U.S. intervention in Iran from 1953 to today, the building blocks, the foundations of the real problems in the U.S.-Iran relationship. Fires continue to burn in Australia as there is no real response from the Australian right-wing government. Millions flood the street in India for a general strike as part of a flexing of labor power and opposition to Modi's extremist discriminatory regime. Most Americans believe that the assassination of Soleimani made the U.S. less safe, but there's still a big split in whether or not it was the right thing to do. More than 180 events are planned across the United States to protest against warmongering against Iran. GOP lawmakers called the Trump administration's briefing on the Soleimani assassination insulting and demeaning, as Mike Lee and Rand Paul indicate they'll support reining the administration in. The House is set to vote on a war powers resolution, although it is not the progressive option. It does not appear to be the progressive one that had been put forward by Ro Khanna. Senate Democrats say it's time to send impeachment articles to the Senate. Northern Syria depends on UN aid. Its delivery could end tomorrow. The Trump administration wants to change environmental rules to speed up highway construction projects, pipelines, and more. Steve Mnuchin seeks a delay on proposed disclosure of Secret Service spending on presidential travel until after the election. And the Sunrise Movement, the movement of millennials serious about actually doing something about the global ecological crisis, have chosen the candidate with the most serious plan. They have endorsed Senator Bernie Sanders for president. Atlanta Hawks star Trey Young has personally is contributed $1 million to cancel medical debt in the city of Atlanta. Great, awesome personal generosity. And of course, we need to eliminate all medical debt, and it cannot come down to somebody's personal goodness. However, that is an incredibly awesome thing of him to do. All that and more on today's Majority Report. We're here, three of us. It's Leck Day, Brendan Day, and Michael Day. Leck telling us about how excited he is to see a chiropractor. Some new work he's been doing with sound healing.
You're doing gong baths and things like that.
Yeah, Matt's doing gong baths. It's a change in the Matt arc.
Politics has gotten just so out of whack, but it's going to come back in whack.
Hopefully my neck will too.
Wait, who's... Is that a Biden thing?
The Biden clip.
Oh my God. The guy is deteriorating in front of all of us. It's like everybody is just... It is so weird how everybody... Like Warren with the constant selfie stuff and just Biden just deteriorating. What's going on with these people?
This show has gotten to the size where we're now listened to by staffs of politicians. And can we just say,
Drop out if you're not Bernie Sanders.
Well, also, just specifically to that point, if you're on Warren's staff, can you please, and you can use this as to bolster your opinion, just fight against whoever's telling Warren to continually mention the selfies? Or at least give her selfie stick
so that we can at least like call them properly selfies. We're not trying to be pedants here, but like people online are going to keep saying that.
I would say just go for it. I take it back. I think it looked great that on the night of a possible global conflict emanating out of Iran, that it was a selfie night. Go for it. So obviously, when we talk about this quite a bit, Congress reasserting its role in democratizing foreign policy and specifically reining in endless global war making. I really like the point that we were talking about on TMBS the other night, that this notion of like World War III is this very melodramatic, terrifying, almost kind of mind thrill seeking apocalypse scenario. And look, I don't certainly, as we transition into a, you know, a G2 world, the United States and China, and there's a greater resource conflict, yes, there's a lot of dangers. But that type of scenario is still relatively unlikely. We could, if we thought about it a little bit more in a little bit more of a disciplined way, we have been in the form of World War III, at least since the Bush administration invaded Afghanistan and implemented the whole range of policies on the so-called war on terror. We have drones active across the globe. We from Africa, South Asia, the Middle East. We have radically militarized the war on drugs in Mexico, as an example, just as we did in Colombia, in fact. So this, you know, Congress getting back in control of this process, yes, first and foremost, is to stop the catastrophic emergency of greater Trump administration escalating against Iran. But it's also about a completely unaccountable bureaucracy that encompasses defense, intelligence, the executive branch, and a whole global framework of war making, which kills a lot of innocent people across the globe and has obviously not made anybody safer. Of course, it makes defense contractors a huge amount of money. Of course, it employs a lot of people. Of course, it can muscle our way into certain vital natural resources. You know, the real aims of these policies can be satisfied. But if we're thinking in democratic, humanitarian, and sustainability terms, we need to get that in order immediately. Now, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, looking as happy as ever, disagrees with that viewpoint, and she sat down with the ever-brilliant brain trust at Fox & Friends to break it down.
Go ahead.
Sarah, the president said yesterday the U.S. is ready to embrace peace. He's calling for more economic sanctions on Iran's already struggling economy. He did say that Iran is standing down. So why is the House putting up this resolution to try to limit the president's powers?
You know, I can't think of anything dumber than allowing Congress to take over our foreign policy. They can't seem to manage to get much of anything done. I think the last thing we want to do is push powers into Congress's hands and take them away from the president. Any Democrat that doesn't understand that America is safer now that one of the most dangerous terrorists in the world is rotting in hell is completely naive and completely misses what we need to have in a foreign policy. And the last thing I want to do is see them take power away from President Trump and put it into their own hands. I don't think anything could be worse for America.
Okay. I mean, first and foremost, obviously, that's pure authoritarianism. That is pure authoritarianism. Usually I remember back in the day when, you know, flag waving, rah, 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 Republicans pretended to respect the Constitution. This is purely unconstitutional. And you are seeing at least some rhetorical. I'm never going to give people like Mike Lee or Rand Paul credit until they actually vote on some of these things. But you're seeing the rhetorical indications. And Rand Paul did vote against the 2017 Iran sanctions along with Bernie Sanders, which was really shaping up to be maybe the most important international vote that you could cast in the last couple of years. And everybody voted in the Senate voted the wrong way besides Sanders and Paul. Most Americans actually disagree with this, you know, stunning stupidity and authoritarianism you just saw there. This is a new poll from USA Today and Ipsos. And the takeaways are that 28% of Americans say much less safe, 27% say somewhat less safe, 21% don't know, 15% say much more safe, and 9% say 25% say somewhat more safe, 9% say much more safe. 42% supported the assassination of Soleimani, 33% opposed it, and 25% say they don't know what to think. Obviously, of course, Republicans are much more supportive than Democrats, and independents are almost evenly split. And, you know, those numbers relative to somebody who grew up, you know, or not didn't grow up, but was, you know, young and saw like the pure bloodlust and cult-like alignment under the Bush administration and the so-called war on terrorism, Afghanistan. And then, of course, just the relentless lie and propaganda campaign before the invasion of Iraq. That's somewhat encouraging. At the same time, you know, I think what's holding us back here is basically Trump's anxiety about actually getting in deeper. And I think clearly you have a Republican base. I think there's some people on the margins that genuinely would like to step back from interventionism. But I think most of these, you know, most of the people who think Trump is just great are just, you know, again, they're in that mindset she just expressed right there. Authoritarian. So we'll see how things progress. Iran obviously engaged in a proportional response, and that was, according to Pepe Escobar's reporting, there was even some type of a back channel through Qatar basically saying, you know, can we, pre-agree on something like that? And again, just objectively, watch as Iran continues to be the relatively speaking responsible party here. It is what it is.
It's weird when a Huckabee challenges you to think of anything dumber than anything else.
I like that. You waited in the cut for that one. That was good. All right, guys, we're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back with Professor Gene Bajelon. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Definitely have ceded authority on interstitial selection. Joining us now is Gene Bajelon. He's a professor of history at Missouri State University. Gene, got an echo.
I don't know what's happening.
Okay. Gene, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's good to speak to you. I hope it's sad that we have to speak under such unfortunate circumstances at the moment.
Well, that was actually, maybe we'll start just with a little bit of an update. I mean, obviously, this has been catastrophic. You know, we have this assassination, this major escalation by Trump, then a, you know, very calibrated response. And then what, I mean, look, additional sanctions against Iran are obviously going to be terrible for the Iranian people. But it did seem to me that a very slurry and kind of oddly sedated Trump, stood down a bit yesterday. And now we have, you know, some Republican senators at least beating up on the security briefings here. So do you think that, I mean, look, obviously this is all incredibly dangerous and taking this course of action is, you know, mind-bogglingly reckless and stupid, and part of a much bigger set of problems, which we'll talk about in a minute. But did things seem to be a bit cooled, relatively speaking, to you?
I certainly think things have cooled down a little bit. It was a stressful night for, you know, everybody who's both, you know, interested in the Middle East and has family or friends in the Middle East. The other day when we had the Iranian counterstrike with those missiles, it was very stressful for people in Iraq who've already gone through, you know, so much over the last decade and a half. So, you know, it's seems that we have once again stepped back from the brink. If you remember a couple of months back, we had that scare with following the downing of the U.S. drone. But, you know, this is just an unending sort of, this is just sort of a continuing cycle where we see a ramp up to war, then a step back. And, you know, this is extremely dangerous because, you know, sometimes things can get out of control. Accidents do happen. And, you know, when people, you know, even if people don't intend to get us dragged into a war, things could escalate out of, you know, escalate in such a way that conflict picks up and becomes not inevitable, but conflict picks up and breaks out without people really intending that. You know, I don't think Donald Trump really wants to get into a full-scale war with Iran. I think there are certainly people around him who do. You have, you know, Pompeo, you have Pence, and you know, you have other neoconservative figures who have long wanted to attack Iran. But, you know, I think Trump's instinct is to avoid that kind of conflict. But, you know, Trump is a relatively incoherent president, so it's very difficult to predict, you know, which way he's going to go.
Let's go back to 1953. I mean, we've talked about this sort of thing in so many different forums, and I think people have a rough sense. But I think it would be great to just have a very clear crash course here on the scale. I mean, if we take it back even further than that, there's obviously a lot of British interference, and you know, there's many colonial powers playing colonial games. But specifically, the U.S. relationship with Iran. Can you give us a kind of crash course of the different flashpoints here, going back to the 1953 CIA coup that removed Mossadegh? And what Mossadegh, let's actually really start there. What was Mossadegh trying to do? And why is this event that is like, you know, most Americans probably have no idea about, why is the, I mean, this is still a core part of the Iranian story.
Yeah, so basically what happened in the early 1950s is that Mohammad Mossadegh came to power in Iran as the prime minister. And Mossadegh was, you know, often he's portrayed as being a communist or a communist sympathizer, but he was no communist. He was a nationalist. He was a veteran member of the Iranian parliament. There had been a revolution in Iran in 1906, and he was an early member of that parliament who sort of had a long history of parliamentary activities. And, you know, as a senior statesman, he eventually came to power with a plan to nationalize Iran's oil. And at that time, basically, Iran's oil was under the control of Britain. So 1953 is an interesting point because it's kind of a period in which we not only do we see America ramping up its intervention into Iran, but we also see the decline of the British Empire. If I might take things back a little bit further,
please.
You know, during the 19th century, you know, we see the origins of the modern Iranian state, and the reform movement in the 19th century was a relatively lethargic one in Iran. The ruling Qajar dynasty, rather than sort of attempting to centralize power vigorously, generally sought to extract money by selling off the country's natural resources. So you have attempts to sell off things such as you have a huge concession given called the Reuters concession. Then you have a tobacco concession, which leads to protests. And then you have the Diachi concession in the early 20th century, which lays the foundation for the formation of Anglo-Iranian Oil, which became British Petroleum, and which really took over the Iranian oil industry. So basically, we have this history of Britain and also Russia during the 19th century, you know, basically collaborating with the ruling family and the ruling government of Iran to, you know, take control of Iran's resources. Now, in 1906, there was a constitutional revolution, as I mentioned. And one of the interesting sort of ironies of history is that, you know, crushed between Russian and British imperialism, the constitutionalists who came to power after this revolution, which was eventually crushed by Russia and Britain, looked to the United States as a kind of third power that could perhaps, you know, assist them in gaining independence. And we have William Morgan Schuster being dispatched to the country, you know, trying to help the constitutional regime to sort of reform itself and resist British and Russian imperialism. This obviously failed. And, you know, Schuster, who became obviously well-known in the publishing industry in the United States, wrote a book called The Strangling of Persia, where he sees how these imperial powers sort of, you know, were stymieing any kind of reform in the country. Now, fast forward to after the First World War, Britain attempts to impose a protectorate over the country. This doesn't quite work out, but, you know, they back Reza Shah, who overthrows the Qajar dynasty and really begins the process of centralizing power in the state, creating the modern Iranian state. Over the course of the 20th century, no country changed, perhaps other than Saudi Arabia, as much as Iran. Iran was a relatively decentralized state before, you know, at the beginning of the 20th century. By the 1970s, it was one of the most modern and advanced states in the Middle East. So they back Reza Shah. He begins this process of centralization. But during the Second World War, the Shah attempts to balance British and Soviet influence by looking towards Nazi Germany. And again, during the context of the Second World War, this is unacceptable. Britain and the Soviet Union invade and, you know, partition the country during the course of the war. Following the end of the war, the Soviet Union attempts to annex the Azerbaijan region of Iran. Does, you know, Soviet Azerbaijan and Iranian Azerbaijan, the Soviets occupy that region during the war and attempt to bring that into the Soviet Union. But of course, they are stopped by, you know, the threat of the United States, which at that point possessed the nuclear bomb, whereas Stalin did not possess the nuclear bomb. But Iranian state during the Second World War is that you have the emergence of kind of democracy. Mohammad Reza Shah is basically placed onto the Iranian throne, and he's a relatively weak character at the beginning of things. And in the place, we see the Majlis, the parliament, increase in power, and this culminates in the early 50s with Mossadegh, who, like I said, is not a communist, but is a nationalist seeking to take control of Iran's natural resources. Iranians were tired of having their natural resources benefiting foreign multinational companies like Anglo-Iranian Oil, BP, and basically Mossadegh attempted to sort of you know, do something about that. And this, of course, distressed the British Empire, which was, you know, increasingly in a difficult economic position. You know, the war had bankrupt the empire. So, you know, control of the Iranian oil industry was extremely important for the British. And what happens basically is the crisis between Britain and the Iranians gets worse and worse. And the British basically convinced the Americans that, you know, Mossadegh is a communist stooge, and we see the United States and Britain together working to overthrow this government, which ultimately this is an intelligence operation, Operation Ajax, and, you know, the elected prime minister of Iran is captured, and the Shah is, you know, basically who had briefly fled the country, basically installed in power as a dictator. And from this point over, we see sort of British influence declining and the United States becoming the primary imperial power, a primary backer of the Shah's regime. So, you know, this is an important transition point.
Yeah. And I just, and maybe then we could, you know, move towards the 70s, but just briefly, I mean, the Shah is just kind of what people would expect. I mean, you know, incredibly brutal. There's a really vicious internal intelligence service, suppression, very big income inequality. There's also, and I think this is an important distinction for people to make, you know, again, we're not talking about, we don't want a religious state. That wouldn't be our political preference, obviously. But, you know, you're talking about a lot of what is not really deep secular politics. It's just sort of using, attacking religion basically as another agent of kind of class suppression. But also because, you know, of the destruction of civil society, the sort of the mosque is actually one of the only places where there's still some actual ability for people to meet and sort of discuss politics and things like that without complete oversight. And then the other thing that I think is maybe also important to touch on is it isn't just that, you know, it isn't just sort of like, okay, this is a, you know, a Western oriented U.S. Backed dictator in an oil rich place. The Shah, along, you know, in this period, there's a partnership that's developed in the intelligence services connecting the CIA, the Israeli intelligence, Turkish and Iranian. So this is a very active agent of U.S. Interest and intelligence operations in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important for people, you know, often, you know, on the left, or at least some elements on the left, get a little bit lazy when talking about interest, whereas, you know, everybody is a puppet of the U.S. But of course, the Shah had his own particular interests, which he followed. Internally, this meant centralizing power, continuing the centralization of politics in Iran, this nation-building process, which his father had, you know, begun in earnest in the 1920s. And this, as you rightly point out, means the destruction of civil society, you know, a process which, you know, really took off in the 1960s following the what was known as the white revolution, attempt to kind of like modernize Iran at breakneck speed, to co-opt sort of you know, socially liberal or Western looking kind of facing elites into the society and sort of drag Iran into kind of what the Shah viewed as being an appropriate form of modernity, which included a rejection of the Islamic past in many ways. So he, you know, he continued that process, which eventually led to the fact that the, you know, the mosque remained this, you know, last bastion of semi-independent civil society from the Shah, and an important center of opposition. This was not a new thing, you know. The role of the ulema, the clerics of the cleric scholars of Shia Islam, goes back to the 19th century. They were critical in the protests of the 1890s, which reversed the tobacco concession. They were critical in the constitutional revolution period. So, you know, the mosque has played an important role. It, you know, didn't come out of nowhere. In the 1970s, important node of opposition to imperial and Shah and royal power in Iran. Externally, the Shah also had his own interest, which was, of course, to assert Iranian primacy over the Middle East. And this, you know, this is actually a continuity with the Islamic Republic, the difference being that the Shah generally sought to advance Iran's foreign policy interests in concert with the United States, using, you know, through common opposition to the Soviet Union, through anti-communism, basically within the context of the Cold War, which meant relinquishing Iran's claims over Bahrain in the early 1970s, making an agreement with Saddam Hussein of Iraq in 1975, helping the Omanis defeat left-wing insurgents in their country, and supporting what the Americans viewed as moderate leaders across the Middle East, from Jordan to Libya. In fact, the Shah's influence extended even beyond the Middle East. When when the dictatorship in Spain fell, the Shah supported right-wing forces to avoid a complete left-wing takeover of Spanish politics. He provided money to them to support the royal family. So, you know, this is the Shah played an, you know, had his own interests, and of course these were in concert with you know, in many ways were in concert with Iran.
So then talk about
the
U.S.
States.
Yeah. So talk about then, I guess, you know, the revolution, how it maybe briefly how a kind of multi-factional revolution turns into a Islamic one. And to be really clear, there was always obviously a major role. The Ayatollah, the Muslim forces were incredibly important in this revolution. But there was also a left. There was also a liberal faction who ended up being marginalized. And then maybe through then, can you take us, you know, and then, of course, there's the hostage crisis, which is a, you know, was a, obviously a violation and an enduring sense of massive grievance. It seems to me, even in the main, for people who actually weren't the victims of it, a lot of the people who actually went through this horrible experience seem to have much more sort of thoughtful and interesting takes on what that relationship could be. And then in the 1980s, maybe specifically, because I think the other major event is obviously the Iran-Iraq War, and then having the United States and other, you know, major players in the West be supplying Saddam Hussein while he attacks Iran with chemical weapons.
Yeah. I mean, so if we you know, look at the context of the revolution, you know, it's often called an Islamic revolution. Of course, Islam is important in that revolution, as you know. But, you know, it's a nationalist revolution in many ways. Islam is becomes an important symbolic resource for the nationalists to mobilize to sort of build a sort of an Iranian identity that separates itself from the sort of secular pre-Islamic Iranian identity promoted by the Shah and his followers. So, of course, because of the dictatorship of the Shah, we see a radicalization in Iranian politics, which hollows out the sort of liberal reformist center. And we see communists and Islamists increasingly becoming powerful in the country. And, of course, the U.S., with its support for the regime, as well as, you know, important symbolic issues such as the extraterritorial rights that Americans enjoyed in Iran, you know, which was seen as a big violation of Iranian sovereignty. All these things helped, created a tinderbox, which the country was ready to explode. You know, so we see in the late 1970s, the Iranian economy, basically, you know, the Iranian regime had been sort of sustained by sort of economic success in the 60s and 70s, growth, you know, wage growth. But eventually, you know, we have an overheating of the Iranian economy. We have, you know, inflation. We have, you know, we have a sort of massive movement of rural population into the cities, which is exacerbated by the Shah's policies. And this creates a crisis, which, you know, eventually overthrows the regime in 1979. And we have basically coming to the fore, you know, left-wing forces and Islamist forces cooperating. And, once the Shah leaves in 79, we see sort of this process by which, you know, fall post-revolution, there is, you know, from the left-wing perspective, a counter-revolution in which conservative forces that had been allied with the left, and, you know, we can also talk about the strategic mistakes made by the Iranian left, which many Iranian leftists backed Khomeini, seeing him as being, you know, a potentially a weak figurehead for the revolution. But when he got into power, of course, you know, he very quickly began to consolidate power. And
I talked to someone who was involved very significantly, actually held an ambassadorial role in the first revolutionary government. And this is somebody who's, you know, Iranian, completely secular, I would say a social democrat sort of politics. And he said, yeah, I thought that in the same way that the Congress party in India had Gandhi, and of course there was this, you know, Hindu and spiritual dimension, but he's like, I thought the Ayatollah was totally an analogous figure. And of course Gandhi was a very shrewd politician too, but he was also a Democrat. For his flaws. And I think, yeah, that just to underline that people really did have a sense of the Ayatollah as some type of, maybe with greater or lesser degrees of power, but some type of kind of moral sort of organizing force or figurehead, and not this actually really effective kind of brutal Machiavellian character that he turns out to be.
Yeah, I mean, the only group in Iran that, you know, sort of recognized the danger of Khomeini and the Islamists were the Kurdish movement, because of course they weren't Shia, so, you know, a lot of the Shia ideology was seen very threatening. So we see, you know, the first major suppression after the revolution takes place in Kurdistan, which is important to note because many of the figures in the regime, including Qasem Soleimani, but also including reformists, like Jalil Pour, who these young men in their 20s were sent to Kurdistan to, you know, crush the pro-autonomy movement there. So, you know, there were groups that opposed it, but in general, sort of people rallied behind the regime. And when the Iran-Iraq war broke out, this provided further impetus to sort of crush any oppositional forces. So in the early 80s, we see widespread suppression of the left, and really the extermination of an entire generation of the Iranian left who are either killed or flee to Europe and the United States. So this is an important thing to understand about we see a revolution being sort of taken over by right-wing political forces very soon after the fall of the regime.
Then in the 1980s, though, it's very important to, let's cover the Iran-Iraq war and the U.S. role in it.
Sure. I mean, before I get to the Iran-Iraq war, I just want to note the Reagan administration, in many ways came to power thanks to the the hardliners in the Iranian regime. So, there is always to some degree, whether sort of conscious or unconscious, some kind of symbiotic relationship between hardliners in Iran and the United States.
Well, and maybe even mention Iran-Contra. I mean, I mean, we're literally talking about basically part of it is actually the Iranians basically saying, if we have plausible deniability, we'll take arms from Israel. And then the United States are basically illegally funneling weapons to the Iranians during this war as well, so they can fund their, death squads that they're backing across Latin America, which Congress had cut funding off for. So, yes, there's always seems to be on a subconscious level, the right wing politics are synchronized.
Yeah, exactly. So we see the Americans, obviously, the Americans and the Soviet Union backing the Iraqis in their invasion in the early 1980s. And, the Iraqis act extremely brutally in Iran. And, this invasion actually helps consolidate a hardline regime. And the war basically goes on. The United States, for example, continuously sort of supports the Iraqis diplomatically, even after the Iraqis start using chemical weapons against Iranian forces, which is, of course, illegal under international law. So we have, Saddam Hussein, people of Iraqi regime, which was getting all kinds of plaudits. There's a good picture that always does the rounds at times of crisis with Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with Saddam Hussein in the mid-1980s. In Iran, they call this the it was a war, basically, which many Iranians see as being imposed by the United States. That the Iraqis had their own reasons for invading Iran, but of course, this wouldn't have been possible without a green light from the United States or the Soviet Union. And the cost to Iranians was enormous. You have the regime consolidating, but you have, hundreds of thousands of people, young Iranians, going to war, and the regime, sending wave after wave of Iranians into combat, including underage kids to defend their country against the Iraqi invasion. So, you have this tragic war, which is started by the Iraqis. And when the Iranians get the upper hand, the United States begins to not simply support the Iraqis diplomatically or with credit so that they can buy their Soviet weapons. Interesting thing about the Iraqi army was that, they had a lot of Soviet equipment. They had a lot of French equipment and, a big hodgepodge of different equipment because, they were backed by both sides of the Cold War in many ways. And so when we get to 1980, when the Iraqi regime is sort of being pushed back, we see the Americans in the spring of 1980 basically sinking the Iranian Navy. There's an operation known as Operation Praying Mantis, which is a response to the Iranians mining the Gulf. And this, the Americans attack Iranian territorial waters and sink their Navy. And this is followed, I think, a month later by the attack, the shooting down of an Iranian passenger jet, which, whether or not, was deliberate, was seen by the Iranians as being, well, the Americans are willing to take any kind of step to stop us and sort of forces the two sides to peace, which the Iranians were extremely bitter about because their country had been invaded.
And also, to be really clear, I mean, yes, just this is really important. We talked about this yesterday. The United States shoots down a commercial passenger jet. They claim that it was outside of its, you know, its airspace. It was not. And then to make matters, you know, worse, particularly obviously all of this garbage about, you know, a lot of sort of cultural explanations of actual material politics are, you know, overblown at best and stupid and essentialist at worst and mostly. But, you know, people everywhere take apologies and symbolism seriously. And so after you blow a civilian jet out of the sky, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush fighting the wimp factor says, we don't apologize. So literally, we're going to, you know, at best, by being absolutely reckless, kill a bunch of innocent, you know, citizens, and then just sort of throw salt on it by not apologizing. And I think everybody knows, and this isn't even who cares about it? This isn't even a point about hypocrisy. This is a basic human thing. If, you know, if somebody blew a U.S. jet out of the air and then basically said, nah, first lied about it and then said, screw you, we would all be rightfully disgusted and angry, just as, you know, I mean, I can't think of a single country in the world that wouldn't have that response. It's just basic human stuff here. So that's another thing on the kind of Iranian side of the ledger. I know that there's a lot, obviously, that happens. There's things that happened in the 90s, and there's things that happened in the Ahmadinejad era. But I just, because we're in the interest of time, I think the other two things that are really important to hit are the serious potential and very earnest diplomacy under Khatami, which is rejected, you know, most infamously in the David Frum penned Axis of Evil speech. And we're talking about, you know, Khatami, a leader who had, you know, not as much internal, I mean, he was a democratically elected president, distrusted by a lot of people in the Iranian, in the other parts of the Iranian government. So, you know, he might have been very well have been undermined, but he seemed to be even more interested in potentially something even more comprehensive and resetting than what came later. And then, of course, let's just talk about that first. I do want to get more current, but talk a little bit about Khatami, who was president from 1997 to 2005, and the very serious outreach that happened from Iran at that time, and how the neocons and the Bush administration chose to respond to that.
Yeah, so, you know, in the 90s, you have this election of what they call reformists in Iran. And I would note the kind of, in my opinion, the primary difference between reformists and hardliners in Iran is actually less on domestic politics and more on, you know, how they interact with the world. And Khatami, you know, attempted to, improve relations with the United States. And there was a lot of sort of, potential policy overlap between the two, particularly with regards to opposition to Iraq, which emerges during the, following 9/11, as well as Afghanistan. During the 90s, my dad got a satellite dish to watch Kurdish TV. And I used to watch the Iranian news channel sometimes. And they would always refer to the Northern Alliance as the Islamic government of Afghanistan rather than the Taliban. So, you know, they were certainly, even after 9/11, there was a very good opportunity for to engage based on common foreign policy goals.
Gene, you're cutting out. You're cutting out, Gene. Sorry. So I don't know. I mean, just yeah, you're good. It happens every once in a while. I don't know whether you're moving or not, but now you sound great. Mm-hmm. So please stay there. Yeah, no worries.
Yeah, so basically, you had a lot of potential overlap because the people after 9/11 that the United States were against in Afghanistan were the same ones the Iranians had opposed. And, you know, in the late 90s, the Iranians mobilized military forces on the Afghan border because of the threat of the Taliban. You know, the Iranians had no love for the Iraqi government. So, you know, we have people like David Frum and the neocons in the Bush administration, who basically needlessly undermined the reformists, which paved the way in 2005 for the election of Ahmadinejad. So, you know, this is why people like David Frum, when they're going around acting as, you know, arbiters of the resistance, should be, and people who decide to platform them, should really be questioned about what they're doing. This guy writing that speech really had, you know, and symbols matter in politics, really had a deleterious effect on stability in the region. And of course, after the war in Iraq takes place, we see the United States and Iran fighting a proxy war in Iraq. And of course, Iraqis are the ones who suffered the most from that. So, you know, the Bush administration is completely, you know, unnecessary provoking of Iran, whatever we think about the Iranian regime, I'm certainly no fan of the Iranian regime, did not really help many people and created, you know, probably exacerbated the violence in Iraq at the cost of many Iraqi lives.
And then we have, you know, the phase we're in now. And I want to just also touch on, I think this is actually really important history. In 2010, President Lula of Brazil actually negotiated a deal that was very similar on the Iranian nuclear weapons program as to what would end up being signed several years later, you know, by President Obama and negotiating partners. And, you know, the view from Brazil and other sort of developing countries involved in this process, Turkey was as well, which I'm very sympathetic to, is that, like, look, this was actually this was a real deal, and it was very similar, maybe even better in some respects than what would come later. And the reason that it was just sort of rejected out of hand by the West and by Merkel and Obama was essentially just, you know, we can't have players like Brazil negotiating stuff like this. This needs to come from Washington or Berlin. And I think that that's really important history. And I think it's also important to underline, because even under Ahmadinejad, there was a willingness in Iran because of its own, again, just like as you say, its own tactical and strategic considerations, its own eyeing of the Middle East and its own interests to negotiate some sort of deal with the United States. Then we have this Iran deal that, by all accounts, Iran followed closely. And then, you know, of course, Trump. Is it, in addition to the ideological foundations of all the people around Trump egging on war and conflict, do you think there's also just a real sort of delusion and misreading, in the sense that these are the types of people that could hear reports from Iran that people are protesting because people are angry about inequality or social repression or, you know, labor suppression, other real serious problems in Iran. And then they see that as, confuse that as they would with some type of desire for an outside coup or invasion. Like, what is the actual, you know, thinking here in the context of that history?
It's a very interesting question. And, you know, what I find interesting about this assassination that took place recently is the sort of the focus on the individual as being, you know, like critical to the functioning of a regime. You know, there's, you know, people familiar with the functioning of the Revolutionary Guard, you know, don't think that the assassination of Qasem Soleimani is going to make a difference. But it reminded me of the initial strike at the beginning of the Iraq War, which was sort of dedicated to assassinating Saddam Hussein, as if you take out one person, you're going to be able to kind of a sort of non-state actor, the taking out of a political leader can, you know, can have a serious effect on the organization. But when we're dealing with a nation state with the power of, you know, with the monopoly of violence and the ability to tax, you know, the individual is less important. But it does speak to a kind of worldview that sees individuals as being critical. You know, the joke my wife often makes is like, well, you know, liberals and conservatives often talk about assassinations, when really, if you want to change things, you need a guillotine. You know, it's like, it's not about the, you know, it's not about getting rid of individuals. But I think there are people out there who think that you just take out one person and you'll suddenly solve your problems, which that's not how it works when you have these large bureaucratic structures. So I think it's a kind of weird libertarianism almost in some way that looks at politics as this kind of great man theory. So, you know, you take out the great man. Did the taking out of Osama bin Laden end Islamic terrorism? Has ISIS disappeared since al-Baghdadi was assassinated? You know, take it, different examples. You know, the Turkish government arrested Abdullah Öcalan in 1999, and the PKK is still a major force in amongst the Kurds of Turkey and to some extent in Iraq as well. So, you know, this, it's a very it's a kind of worldview which I think is fundamentally misunderstands how political power operates.
So what, just in a more narrow way, and there's so much more to look at. I mean, there's obviously, as you said, the again, this, the way Iraq is constantly victimized in these dynamics, going back to the U.S. invasion. There's the, you know, recklessness of Netanyahu and MBS, and what are the Israeli and Gulf interests and so on. And then also how this, we talked on my show the other day about how this could be undermining, you know, particularly this incredible cross-sectarian movement emerging in Lebanon. But taking it slightly more narrowly, but maybe it touches on those other things I mentioned. I mean, what if, you know, obviously the person who is the most serious about this and has some voting record to match it is Sanders. But, you know, what are the practical things that leadership could do to bring us back here, to, you know, I mean, to the extent any line can be held against Trump, I mean, we have no democratic accountability in foreign policy right now, and small d democratic. So that's one, you know, dealing with an ongoing emergency as long as this idiot is president and the goons around him are empowered. But what would, you know, so that's one part of it. And then the other part, and I'm presuming here, somebody who actually might want to at least attempt some actual reform in U.S. foreign policy and bring us back here, you know, what are the kind of roadmaps of what could actually be done?
It's a difficult question. I mean, I don't mean to sound pessimistic, but, you know, the biggest blow that Trump has done has been to pull out of the Iran deal, right, not simply because he pulled out of a deal which was limiting Iran's nuclear ambitions. And that's an important thing for everybody, because if Iran gets a nuke, we're going to see Turkey and Saudi Arabia wanting a nuke. And the last thing we need is a nuclearized Middle East.
But can I, but question Gene, is Gene, now, can I ask you,
who can trust? But can, who can I just trust the United States?
Well, right. But can I also just ask you really quickly? I mean, you know, one, it is important to note that there's no, you know, there's never any conclusive evidence that Iran was ever weaponizing. That has never been proven. And the second thing is, yes, it would be bad in the broader Middle East, but I mean, what other rational conclusion could Iran get from all of this other than they should have a nuke?
Oh, no, exactly. This is, yeah, you know, the lesson is, you know, Kim Jong-un has nuclear weapons.
Right.
Iran does not. And, you know, Kim Jong-un gets the proper treatment. You know, it's entirely rational to want to have a nuclear weapon. You know, whether or not their program was, you know, there's a lot of debate. That they were actually pushing for a nuke is not as conclusive as people in the United States often think it is. But the point is, it's the point is this exactly goads the Iranians into realizing the need for a nuclear weapon. If you have a nuclear weapon, you're taken seriously, right, like North Korea is. If you don't have a nuclear weapon, well, you know, your military officials can be assassinated at any moment, and you know, you can be placed under pressure. So you get treated differently in the international circumstances. And the problem is, you know, I'm sure President Sanders would attempt to de-escalate, would try to move back to the Iran nuclear deal, would, you know, perhaps relieve, you know, offer some sanction relief. You know, there would be an out, you know, for the Iranian regime. But then the question becomes, you know, U.S. politics has elections. And, you know, what happens if we have, you know, 8 years of Bernie Sanders and then President Tom Cotton, right, or President Ted Cruz? Then, you know, these leaders in the Middle East can't just calculate for the length of a particular administration. So in many ways, I think Trump has done irrevocable damage to the United States' ability to, you know, to engage in diplomacy across the region.
Well, Gene Bajelon, there you have it. That makes a lot of sense. Actually, Gene, wait, there was one thing you wanted to plug. Is that right? Before
that is true. That is true. That is a Bernie Sanders watch party taking place in Springfield, Missouri. So if anybody wants to come to see the debate on Tuesday at 7:30, everybody is meeting at the TGI Fridays restaurant, which is 42 South Stewart Avenue. It's the only TGI Fridays in Springfield. And we'll be watching the debate there. So if, you know, people are in Southwest Missouri and want to watch the debate with everybody, come along.
That's awesome. Gene Bajelon, that's so cool. Gene Bajelon, professor, Missouri State University. Appreciate your time as always, man. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Michael. You take care of yourself.
You too. Take care, brother. All right, folks, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show happens. And how amazing is that? You can also check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. If you haven't yet, subscribe to the YouTube channel, hit the notification bell. Then go right over, if you haven't yet, to the Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel, subscribe and hit the notification bell. We're under 300 subs away from our first 100,000 subscribers on YouTube. So TMBS strong, check it out. And then go to tmbs.fm or go to the Bell House website. Grab your tickets to our live show, February 7th. Really excited about it. Have incredible guests, Alona Minkowski, Brandon Sutton, Ben Burgess, Harvey Kay. And if you're into some old MR nostalgia, Matt Binder is going to join us. It's going to be an incredibly fun show. We're past the halfway point in sales with a month to go. So if the past indicator will sell out, so go grab your tickets quick and come see us. Of course, watch the whole show and get all of the two extra shows a week by becoming a patron at patreon.com/TMBS. Next week, I'm traveling. I'll let people know more about that. So we're actually going to do the main TMBS show next Saturday, but we're premiering an interview Tuesday night with Nando Vila on the collapse of the European dream, European diplomacy with Iran, and what could actually get Europe out of its stagnation. Patreon.com/TMBS. Matt.
Coming up on Literary Hangover, Alex and I will be discussing the Sotweed Factor, and sort of obscure 1708 satirical poem about the Chesapeake Bay and Maryland area, and about how it's a penal colony. So we'll be talking about Benedict Anderson's imagined communities and how satire plays a role in that, because it's all about the sort of snooty English entrepreneur and all the penal colony laborers in Maryland. So we'll be talking about that, how everyone's drunk, how the judges are illiterate and can be bribed easily. So
it's pretty fun, actually.
It's a very interesting poem, very misogynistic, a little bit of he comes across, he's drunk, and he comes across some women playing cards, and he thinks it's a witch's sort of circle. So it's very interesting for 1708.
See, Brendan, you don't have to get upset when you see women playing dominoes on the street in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it's not
a witch's
circle. It's not supernatural.
But there is an origin to your fear.
Exactly. Or at least it's been around for a long time. So
Brendan comes in, he goes, I don't know why these women play dominoes.
And if
there's
people,
a witch's coven in my neighborhood.
If people want to hear me read the poem, they can go to patreon.com/literaryhangover, because I read it. It's about 30 minutes long, and it's in...
you read a 30-minute poem?
It's in Hudibristic couplets, heroic couplet form.
Go so, become right. A patron of Literary Hangover. That's amazing.
Yeah.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
You right. Are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it in my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
almost has what?
The alpha males are back. Back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back. Back, back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ Dannerke song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dannerke.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck. Reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are...
Psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
A hell of a lot of bank.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black Africans. And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Cannot hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday! Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black.
Come on!
What? Come on!
What?
Come on!
Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here!
I am a total
pussy. Pussy.